My name is Jeet here. I won't say too much about the panelists because I'm assuming that everyone here knows who they are. I'll just say that if you're making a list of the dozen greatest cartoonists in the world today, these five gentlemen would be on that list. And Jim Woodring, Dan Clowes, James Sturm, Seth, and Chester Brown. So we'll talk for the next hour, and but 15 minutes before, maybe I will go to some questions from the audience. So what I wanted perhaps to start with was something that Dan had said last night when he was asked about the fact that there probably won't be any more issues of 8-Ball and how the pamphlet comic book has sort of become an antiquarian form. And I'll just show you what one of these things looks like, because I actually think there's probably people in this room who have bought graphic novels but have never bought a comic book. And it's sort of it's interesting because all the five panelists here have started in comic books. They started in this tradition of this pamphlet form that's stapled, that has some sort of periodical regularity, and which now seems like on its way towards obsolescence, being superseded by this form, which we have no good name for, but which is called a graphic novel. So maybe I'll start but there's a lot of young artists. I'm thinking here of Sammy Harkham, who have a real nostalgia for the pamphlet form and who like really envy you guys for like having that form. So maybe we can start with either Dan or Seth to talk about like, do you feel that the form has played itself out, and is there any sense that we're missing something that now it's gone?
I mean, does this work? Yeah. You know, when I first started doing comics, that seemed like the normal venue for what I was doing. You know, it seemed like that's what people were doing. They're doing little pamphlet comics that came out in every 6 months or a year or more frequently. And now that just doesn't seem that it doesn't. That's not what you think of as your venue for comics. Nobody wants to sell comic books anymore because they're too inexpensive, so no bookstore wants to carry them. Comic stores don't even want to carry them. Publishers don't want to publish them.
Yeah.
You just, it feels like, you know, the everything is mounting against that format, and at a certain point, I sort of, you know, I did two issues of 8-Ball that were basically graphic novels in comic form because I was so attached to that format. And I realized at a certain point, why am I doing this? There's no sense to it anymore. And it just seemed, I mean, you're talking about Sammy Harkham and those guys wanting to do that. And I think it is a sort of a nostalgic thing. It has a bit of a feel like they want to be able to say they did a comic like we did.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's necessarily, it just doesn't seem sort of like the vital current thing going on anymore.
Yeah. But also, if you're doing longer works, if I'm doing a long graphic novel, I don't want it chopped up into small sections that people read 20 pages at a time. You know, I want them to be able to read it like one would read a novel.
Yeah, I have real affection for the old comic book format. Is this thing working?
You're just too far away from it.
Oh, okay. Oh, there we go. I have real affection for the comic book itself. But the funny thing is, when I look back now on the comics I did, I wasn't really using the form the way it should be used anyway. I was doing exactly what Chester was talking about, chopping up larger works into small forms. Now that I'm moving into doing books primarily, it seems to me like that when I think of doing a comic, I think it would be exciting to do one more like they should have been done, which is to use them to tell short little stories more like your own anthology, like the way that Dan did with 8-Ball. That seems what the comic book is stronger at. I think I was kind of longing for the graphic novel. And now that it's here, it seems like a natural way for a natural form for the work to be in.
Jim or James, do you want to address this issue? Or like, because you're both now doing sort of graphic novels now rather than serialized stories.
I serialized a comic with Fantagraphics years ago called The Serial Killings in the early 90s, and it was kind of a disaster. And publishing a finished chapter after a finished chapter really didn't make sense for me to work that way because, you know, things that I figured out towards the end of the book, I'd wanted to go back and change. And I was happy to abandon the comic book pretty early on.
Yeah.
I would just like to say I'm glad I lived to see the day where a man would hold up a comic book at a comic convention and say, this is a comic book.
I think some people, to defend myself, some people need to know what it is. Maybe just to pursue this, I mean, Jim, like some of the comics you did have this wonderful energy because you were working with... another artist, and their two styles are very different, and they played off each other in a really interesting way. Like, do you think that's something that's like you would miss, or is it like the advantages of doing a book outweigh all that?
Well, one thing about doing those comics is because they were cheap and somewhat disposable, I think you could take more risks. You could have collaborations and just hope they worked out rather than having to make it work out because you're doing a big hardcover book and there is a lot writing on it. So I don't know if that's good or bad. I think you probably see less spontaneous playfulness in comics now and more hard, ground literature type works. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's a definite change.
Certainly in print, but I think all that experimentation and cross-pollination and experimentation is just happening on webcomics and online instead of on pulp.
It certainly was true that back in the 80s when... most of the alternative cartoonists were working in comic books. It was exciting to see, like, month by month when a comic would come out, to see the medium actually growing as people experimented with things. And there probably is some inhibition to experiment in the same way when you're producing a book, like this kind of solid, finished work that, you know, has to be good. There was a disposable quality to the comics that was appealing and that you could just make a mistake and never have to worry about reprinting it or, you know, it was just, like you say, a disposable item.
Well, yeah, I think, like, especially with maybe Chester's work on Yummy Fur or Dan's work on 8 Ball, like, I think a lot of the nostalgia that the young artist like Sammy Harkham have is that they have this sense that here was a form where an artist could develop and that there was something very satisfying about having like that unit where you see what the artist has been working on the last 6 months or the last 4 months. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of... many of you are known as nostalgists, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of nostalgia for that form on this table.
Well, I still love the old form. I mean, when recently I decided to change Palookaville into a little hardcover magazine, basically. Or I should say my publisher decided it. I did feel like kind of a moment where I felt sort of sad that there weren't going to be any more comic versions. I kind of imagined continuing to put out one every year or two for the rest of my life. And that form really has reached its end as a viable product. And that's kind of... It's you know, like everything... Well, everything in my whole life, it's passing away.
But let me ask you guys this. Are you happier with the publishing experience with books than you were with comics?
Absolutely.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Comics, I remember the 90s as being a period of incredible frustration with the comic books. You know, being angry at my publisher, angry at the stores, angry at the readers, angry at everybody. I don't feel that way anymore.
Oh, but angry why?
Oh, because... Well, I don't want to get too specific. Just basically because I thought nobody else was holding up their end.
Well, I don't know if I was angry back then, but I certainly felt like humiliated always. The whole medium was like you were tied into these comic book shops where your work was like not wanted, and your audience didn't even know that that's where to find your work. And you'd go and do these signings in these places where you would, you know, it was like a pity signing. Like three people would come in and, you know, they'd buy your comic while they were picking up Iron Man. It was depressing. Since we've moved more into the mainstream, it has changed things in a sense that you feel you are actually reaching people who might be interested in what you're doing.
I think that's true, but it seems like books are now the new magazines. People say magazines are dead, but it just seems there's such a short little window that when your book comes out that people are going to pay attention to it before the next publishing list and onslaught of new books come out.
That's true. Yeah, we'll be having this panel about books in a year.
Yeah, books will pass away like everything else. So this is the theme of the panel, the passing of life and our demise.
Yeah, next year, a cartoonist on the iPad.
Apollo Comics.
Well, I mean, I think one change to move on from the past to the like, sort of the present is that you're all doing, you know, you're always ambitious artists from the start, but you're all now doing works of like much greater ambition, and you're all sort of artists at mid-career. And I'm wondering whether there's a, Jim sort of alluded to this, but isn't it kind of like a daunting aspect to this as well, that, you know, you're, and Seth has talked about this, about being that sort of midlife crisis where you know you only have a certain number of books coming up ahead of you and that these books have to be the ones that matter. So like, does this new configuration where you're doing graphic novels, does it have this sort of scary aspect as well? Jim?
No, not anymore for me than previously, because it's always, you know, kind of been about the work, and how it was packaged was a secondary thing. I only wish I were in mid-career. I'm over the hill.
I don't think there's any way. You can't. It's like that kind of pressure. I mean, I don't really feel that. You just do your work. Your work evolves in certain ways, and there's really little you can do about it anyway. I mean, if you got involved in thinking about, you know, like, what's my next book, and how am I going to, like, come up with an idea that will, you know, grab people's attention, or things like that, that's just the wrong kind of thinking anyway. I can't even really imagine putting a book together like that. One project just naturally grows out of the last one. There's a kind of, your work sort of describes itself. You don't really have that much, at least for myself, I don't really have that much choice in what I'm doing. It's, everything's all of a continuum. It would be very hard for me to sit down and think, like, now what could I do would be a book that people would really be interested in? That's just not how my brain operates.
I think Seth said it really well. I mean, yeah. I do think there's a sense of urgency as I get older. There was a point, you know, in your 20s that every great idea you write in your sketchbook and you think you're going to get to this one.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have other obligations in between paying the bills and family. And you just have to, I guess, not choose your projects carefully, because to an extent they do choose you, but it does become a finite amount of time that you have
to work on. Yeah, you've only got so many books. I mean, I do think when you're 20, you think you have like an unending vista of work ahead of you. But certainly, like now that I'm, you know, in my late 40s, I'm really aware that there's just a few more books. And you have like several projects that are sort of rolling around in the back of your brain, and it just depends on which one comes to the surface when the time comes to start the next book. You can't say, like, I've got, you know, the big, great book is waiting out there for me to do, and that's the one I'll start next. It's always just, like, you know, on to the next project.
Yeah. The question I'd have for, well, Dan, yesterday you talked about the Vita story that you kind of threw overboard. I'm wondering, as cartoonists do get to mid-career, whatever that means, whether it's less likely that you're going to go down some dead ends, or as you get older you're a little more aware of the kind of the thematic range of your work.
I mean, in my case, I have so many stories that I'd like to do. Everything I'm working on, every time I work on a book, I think, okay, the next one, I've got to figure out how to do it more quickly. I always think, like, can I just draw it with a Sharpie on type of paper? I've actually thought of hiring assistants. I always fantasize about being like Hergé, you know, where you have people working for you, doing coloring, and you're sort of the director of the whole thing. But that's so antithetical to my own personality. I know it would just, that would multiply the work exponentially. You know, I'd just be doing everybody else's job for them. I'd have to like make small talk with the people coming into my office.
Lots of meetings.
Right.
And so they end up just, pushing, you know, you around.
They would wind up, you know, telling me their ideas, and I'd be too embarrassed to say, like, no, that's horrible. And so, which is basically how it is working on the movies. But so that's my constant concern, is how to, you know, I have three or four books I'd love to do that have been rolling around in my head for 10, 15 years that I don't know how I could ever get them all done, you know, just be...
Yeah,
such an ordeal. So I, you know, at some point I really may start drawing like Jules Feiffer, you know.
Yeah, I'm always trying to do that. I'm always trying to come up with a new style that's simple. Yeah. I'm like, okay, well, this one I'll just draw like in a magic marker. I've been trying that in my sketchbooks, just because everything's such torture to do like in the full finished like approach that you've trained yourself your whole life to do, and then you just desperately want to get away from it. Did you ever read those letters from Roy Crane about his assistant?
No.
Where his assistant was like, he was writing to the syndicate basically to get away from his assistant. Because his assistant was so angry all the time. It was like he was terrorized by his anger.
Sounds like a Tom DeHaven novel.
Yeah.
For the last 10 years of their lives, Roy Crane and his assistant didn't talk to each other. Completely surly. And so the assistant was more trouble than he was worth. As Dan correctly figured it would be.
Yeah.
If they had email, then they'd be in the same cubicle back to back, sending angry emails at one another.
It seems like the books that you guys are doing now are more deliberative in the sense of, you know, like you're thinking things through. I know from talking to Chester that's the case, that, like, you know, after sort of like Underwater, you've sort of decided like each project you're going to take is you're going to have it sort of mapped out. And is it like these sort of concerns about time and, you know, what I can achieve?
Well, I mean, Underwater was just a huge disaster. And, you know, I didn't plan it out properly, and I don't want to make that mistake again. So, yeah, from now on, I'm going to write the script for you before I start, you know, drawing.
Yeah, I think you just get more realistic. You start to see what you're capable of, too. Mm-hmm. You start to see how long everything really takes. And that's why when you say, like, you've got one or two more books, you start adding it up and say, like, well, it took me 10 years to do this book. It's like, I'll live to eight to be 80. So that's there's two more graphic novels there, and then there's that 10 years of decline with a really embarrassing book that your publisher doesn't want to publish.
Doing your porn comic.
the bitter comic at the end.
A graphic novel about Swedenborg.
you're talking about like changing styles, because I wanted to pursue that, because it does seem like with Wimbledon Green, you did find a way of doing, you know, a work without quite the labor intensity, but which is still delightful.
Well, you have to trick yourself with stuff like that. That's why I drew Wimbledon Green in a sketchbook, because the minute I'd taken like a fresh piece of paper out, I would have been forced to do the usual tight finish that I do on all my work. Working in a sketchbook gives you like the excuse to make it crappier. Mm-hmm. And then you just feel like you can just do it in a more perfunctory way, because you've always got that veneer that this is a sketchbook work. And more as I do more comics like that in my sketchbooks, I feel like maybe that's the way to get out of the style that I'm in. I think that's the cartoonist dilemma, is you spend years building up a style, you fetishize certain details about comic art, you know, the way that the line goes down, or, you know, how panels are composed, and then you want this perfect object. And once you get to that point of being able to achieve that level of surface, it becomes a terrible prison. Everything is like far too laborious to produce the work that way. And then I think almost every cartoonist I've ever talked to, it's the same story. Then they spend the rest of their life trying to get away from that style they've developed. And people will say, like, oh, I've done it. I found a way that I can draw the comic much faster. And you're like, that's great. And then you talk to them a month later, and they're like, oh, it didn't work out.
In terms of the artist's dilemma, I mean, it seems like the things that we've been talking about here are thematically very like close to James's latest work, Market Day, because it is kind of about an artist who's struggling to maintain, you know, a level of artistic integrity in a world where that's not appreciated. Is that a fair reading, or?
Well, it's certainly that struggle between making a living and making art certainly is in there. And Market Day came out of what Seth was describing. I was working on a very ambitious book about art and design students, tracking them over their freshman year. And I'd gone through three drafts, and the thing was about 400 pages, and I was looking at this thing and thinking, like, boy, I'm going to finish this in 2087, according to my calculations. And, you know, I didn't want it to be my life's work, and at the same time, I actually had started an actual school as opposed to drawing a school on paper. And something like Market Day was a story that seemed a little closer to the things that I was currently felt cursed by that struggle. And plus, I thought I could get in and get out of it too. It was a shorter work, and that's really important. You know, finding the edges of a project so it doesn't become this big sprawling thing, because as we were discussing earlier, we just don't have the time to figure that all that stuff out now.
Yeah.
You always want what you don't have. I mean, in the early 80s, when most of the cartoonists of our generation came along, that was sort of the rise of the idea of doing long graphic narratives. Comics had always been held down to little 8-page stories, and suddenly it was like the opportunity came to make like long stories, and that seemed to be the future of comics. But of course, once that's becomes the norm, you start longing to do little short 8-page stories that you could just, you know, finish this up and move on to something else. I think it's only natural that there'll always be a reaction against how things are going, even with your own work.
Sure, yeah. I wanted to maybe follow up on the question of ambition and maybe also bring Jim back into the conversation, because I think one of the interesting things about Jim's work among contemporary cartoonists is that it has a religious sensibility, which I think, I think a lot of cartoonists have sort of spiritual concerns, but Jim's work has a sort of religious sensibility, which is very rare, and it's actually even more rare because he's coming out of a religious tradition, which is not orthodox in North America. And I think that, in some ways, like, your work is all, has this huge sort of ambition. I know maybe if that's something I'm reading into it, but then you can tell me. But like, it does seem to like be dealing with these large issues of karma and fate and you know, like the meaning of life through the character's friend.
Yeah.
No, do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Well, no, you can't talk about these things. You have to sneak up on them.
Yeah.
And so, no, I don't want to talk about it overtly.
Okay. Another way of, if they have to sneak up onto you, what is the, why is it useful for you to use these kind of non-human anthropomorphic characters? Like, what is the appeal?
Well, I guess the appeal is that they're kind of beyond time and place. You don't have a sense. The reason the Sprank comics are wordless is because I didn't want the language to, you know, tie it idiomatically to any culture or time or place or anything. So,
wow.
There's also the need to make the work that you're doing interesting to you while you're doing it. And so talking about building up a style that becomes a prison. I remember when I was trying to teach myself to draw and working at it, making occasional little breakthroughs. That was when I enjoyed cartooning the most, before I reached a point where I could just kind of turn it on and turn it off. And I'm always trying to come up with a new style, but I'm not trying to simplify it. I'm trying to get to the point where I feel like I'm riding a wave more than just doing something that I know how to do with a third of my mind. The challenge of drawing things that are invisible, hard to see, hard to convey, even with words, is something I enjoy doing. And the themes that I deal with are things that interest me, and it's just a way of keeping it interesting for myself.
You know, it's funny, Jim, when I was saying that about trying to break out of that prison of a style, I was thinking you're probably the one guy on the panel that wasn't true of. Because I can really feel in your work that the almost fetish-like quality of the finish is so important to the actual work that you wouldn't be trying to get away from that.
Well, it's funny, because when you were saying that, I was thinking, man, that's me, because those goddamn wavy lines I draw, that's a prison if ever there was one. You know, I just have to spend hours and hours just mechanically putting down those lines, and if they get sloppy, they don't work, the density and the closeness of them controls the vibration on the page, and then when it's reduced, that has to work. I mean, this is all factored into it, and it is a prison. It is incredibly irritating to draw all those wavy lines. I've painted myself into a corner, but it's necessary for those stories because they're supposed to have a sense that the whole welkin is vibrating with things you can't see. That's the point of it.
Well, do you not enjoy doing the work, Jim?
I do enjoy doing it. I do enjoy doing it, but I don't enjoy it as much as I used to do when I felt like I was exploring an unknown continent. That was what I really, really liked. And having some doubt about whether or not you would actually be able to get the stuff printed, having some doubt as to whether or not you'd actually be a cartoonist, that was invigorating. You know, you hear rock bands say that the best time was before they became famous. It might be something like that. Not famous, but, you know, accomplished to the point where I could do it, you know.
Yeah.
I always used to say I want to be able to turn it on and off because I would, like, destroy 3 pages before I got one that I liked. And now I can get them the way I like them almost the first time every time. And in a way, that's not as interesting.
Well, it's funny. Comics are a strange form because they demand, like, the actual look of the artwork is as important as the writing. And therefore, you are tied to the visuals in a way that I suspect prose writers are not. I'm sure this conversation wouldn't be going on with prose writers about how they're always trying to get away from using too many descriptives or something.
I thought you were going to say getting away from Helvetica. Or.
Well, I don't know. I think some writers do feel like they're trapped by their style.
You know,
the style imposes, you know, like you spend a lot of time developing a style and then the style becomes a sort of prison. But is it just maybe also part of aging? Like I was thinking about what Jim was just saying, like when you're young, you're discovering the world, and the art is a way of discovering the world, and you're creating a world. And then, like, after you're young, you know, like you're sort of, you've discovered the world, and then you're just maybe just describing it rather than discovering it. I don't know if that's...
When I was doing my early comics, I used to feel so constricted by what I didn't want to draw. I knew I had very limited skills that I needed to work on, and I used to write around the things that I knew were going to be a drag to draw. And I remember really I did not have a good time doing those early eight balls. You know, that should have been a really enthralling time, but it was really stressful, and I just felt like every page I was improving, which made me hate the previous page.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was all just this constant feeling of that I had to go back and correct things, and it just never felt right. And now that I've gotten to the stage where I do feel really comfortable drawing just about anything, it's much, much more fun for me. I've last few things I've done have been just purely fun from beginning to end, except for doing the computer coloring, which is the only part I truly can't stand. But the actual process of drawing, I feel untrapped, actually. You know, I used to feel trapped by my limitations, and now I feel kind of like I could really go anywhere and do anything in a way that I never felt before. So
if you're
it's
not
very
enjoying
different.
The coloring, why not just do black and white comics?
I like the way the color to me adds so much to what I'm doing. I can't see it working without it. And it's not the bulk of my time. It's like a month of complaining and driving my wife crazy. And
a month? It took you like a month to color Wilson?
I'd colored Wilson in a month, yeah.
Okay. So. How long did it take you to color Market Day?
Well, I actually used an assistant, not to actually choose the color palette, but for about maybe two-thirds of the pages, I had somebody trap the color. And I said, if you spend more than 1 second deciding what color goes in there, that's 1 second too many. And for those people who don't know about Photoshop, it's you're just choosing the color fields that are covering a face or a building. And that's a lot of time. And I have very poor vision, which is getting increasingly worse. So the less time I can spend in front of the screen, the better. So that was, you know, $20 a page well spent for me.
$20? Can I hire this person?
That's why you start a cartooning school.
There you go.
Army of young graduate students.
It's true that
pay
there's
you
a
$20.
It's true there's a real like a pleasure that comes when you're riding, like you mentioned, riding the wave. But like I think of when like an athlete when you're working, like you hit like certain points where you're in the groove, kind of, and that's when it is a great pleasure to produce artwork. But I find for myself, as I'm getting older, I'm in that groove a lot less than I used to be. I'm able to do what's required, but I don't feel that same sense where pages are rolling out and the inking is going beautifully. I feel so much frustration with it. I think that's why I constantly am dreaming of some simpler style. And it's always in the finish. It's not in the drawing. It's always in, can I get away from these fucking brushes?
Well, I mean, that sort of... are you perhaps holding yourself to too high a standard? Like, is that the problem? I'm trying to figure out, why...
Well, there is a perfectionism involved.
Yeah.
I mean, I spend, like, a day drawing a page, and then I spend, like, half a day inking it, and then I spend a day whiting it out. And that's the kind of crazy perfectionism where every line becomes important. I mean, it's not that they have to be whited out. When I do full-color artwork where I'm putting color over it, you can't put any whiteout on, so then the lines are perfect.
Right.
When they have to be perfect, they're perfect. But when you can use whiteout, they're not perfect. And so then you go in and you fix every perfect little detail, make everything just right, and touch up everything. And that's where, like, the term fetish, like, there is like some fetishistic quality to producing this thing exactly the way you want it, as close as you can get to some ideal stage. And that's what really slows everything down.
Photoshop breeds that too, because if you scan your pages in and blow them up, you can just feather a line a little more, mm-hmm. move a facial feature a little to the left.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Yes.
Well, no, everyone here, do you all like work with your hands, as Dan was saying last night? Like, is it very important to be drawing? Because Ben Katcher was in town recently. I was quite surprised where he said that he does everything on computer now, just because it's like, A, it's easier, and he feels that print itself is a form of technology.
He doesn't actually draw.
What do you mean does
computer,
everything?
Does
What do you mean does everything?
He draws on, like...
With, like, a mouse
thing? Yeah, or yeah, like a tablet.
Yeah,
tablet.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, which is was shocking to me. So, yeah. But yeah. I mean, like, that so how...
That's horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. But
cross
how important
off the
is
list.
That? Well, to follow up on that, how important is the tactileness of, like, drawing something with your physical hand? Like is that something that's crucial to cartooning? Or can we...
I think just in a purely commercial sense, the one thing that we all have as artists is that we produce these artworks that presumably may one day have some value. You know, if you're in a rock band and everybody's downloading your music, you can play live shows and you have that. But we don't have that. We can't go out and do a little, you know, chalk talk and make, you know, money. And so we have...
Actually, we're going to pass around a hat before this.
Well, we can do our selection plan. Yeah. But we... But we do have this artwork that's, you know, presumably someone will someday, you know, give us some pittance for. But, you know, that's sort of our retirement. And I think people are doing all their work on a computer are going to one day, you know, hit 70 and think, wait a minute, I have nothing. All I can sell is, you know, a disc of my, you know, Photoshop paths or something.
You're living in the past, Dan. It's like the truth is, by the time we're old, people will be happy to have a scan of your original art. They'll just be like, oh, this is my collection of art.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, people still want
to
put something on their wall.
Want a talisman.
Yeah,
they want
I think so.
I feel like cartooning, I mean, I think it's important to draw the comics. I think there's something in the physicality of it that's important. I mean, that's why I think comics are interesting, is that they're hand-drawn. I think that's
sure.
a big part of it. But I do recognize that so much of what we do is the product of the technology that we grew up with. I mean, we draw with brushes and pens because they needed that for photo reproduction. And I think probably in 20 years, the comics will look like they were drawn on computers because that's what the cartoonists, that was the technology they're used to. They probably won't even think about original art. It will probably just be like some guy from 1890 saying, what, you're throwing out your woodcut blocks? That's right. My retirement fund.
We'll be able to corner the market.
Yeah. Well, you know, Brian Boland does all his stuff on a computer. Mm-hmm. And he basically imitates brush lines with the computer, which, I don't know, there's a lot of meaning packed into that, it seems to me. I like... One thing I like about drawing with a pencil and inking with a dip pen is that it's ancient technology, and when you do it, you're doing something that people have done for thousands of years. You know, the Egyptians invented the dip pen, let's say, 3,000 years ago. And it's a little bit of a link with the past and the great pen and ink artists. You know, it's nice to think that you're experiencing a little bit of the same kind of difficulties and troubles and the same pleasure with materials that they did. I like that feeling.
Oh, I certainly agree with that.
Yeah. When Johnson had a great quote when she was writing to Charles Schulz and saying she could never imagine someone else drawing her strip because when she's actually drawing and the pen's touching the page, it's the only time when she's actually physically touching her characters.
Yeah. Hmm.
And I wonder if that was mitigated through a mouse or the technology, whether it would feel less inspired.
Yeah, it does seem like it's creating another layer of alienation between you and the characters and the work. Like, it's just like adding another barrier. But to pick up on what Jim was sort of saying, like the sort of linkage with the past, I think that's one thing that perhaps unites the panelists here, like that everyone here sort of steeped in the comics past in different ways. And Jim, do you want to talk anything about some of the sort of cartoonists like Sullivan or Herbert Crawley that might have like be serve as inspirations for your work?
Well, yeah, Sullivan and Herbert Crawley are two people who... I mean, they've enriched my life immeasurably just by doing the work that they've done. As have so many others, as have these guys here, you know. They've all nourished my psyche with their work.
That's very nice.
There are too many to name. But I get an inordinate amount of pleasure of looking at drawings by Sullivan or A.B. Frost or Harriman or any of those guys. It just comforts me and makes me feel good about humanity to know that there are these grown men devoting themselves to pursuing these ineffable little things that are so hard to describe or characterize.
No, it's true. There's a great beauty to cartooning. I mean, that's one of the reasons, like, as an adult, you stay interested in these works. You look back on these things and they, like you said, they give you great pleasure that they even exist. I mean, 90% of the books in my cartoon library are for that very purpose. You just take them down and there's a great joy in being able to actually just look at the work. Sometimes it's not even a matter of reading some of these works. The times change and the work doesn't speak to you necessarily through the content in the same way, but the actual beauty of the process and the images and even the printing, you know, that really does, like, it's one of the reasons why you feel, like, thrilled to even be connected to the tradition of it. You can think, like, I'm, you know, I might be on the wrong end of the time scale, but I'm on the scale somewhere.
Yeah. There are superhuman achievements in this field. Heinrich Kley, Bill Elder, people do these things and you just wonder, how on earth did these guys knock this stuff out day after day? This is perfection. How did they do it? I can't even imagine it.
I'm always impressed with the cartoonists of the past who worked in a commercial field, like someone like Bill Elder, who put the amount of effort into the work, that they didn't just hack it out, because the desire would be to just hack it out, because who cares? It's like the audience, you weren't getting any kind of feedback that made it that kind of personally gratifying experience, you know, where you have people come up and have your book signed, or people are writing you letters or whatever. It's not that kind of author experience they had. These guys were like, they're in their studios for their whole careers, and they were working for fly-by-night publishers half the time, or a great deal of them could have easily just said, like, just have to draw this awful drawing, I'll just hack it out, make it as simple as possible for myself. But they really poured, like, their effort and skill into it. They were proud of what they did, and that really shines through the work, and is really kind of remarkable.
And in the case of Bill Elder in particular, you know he must have suffered financially for putting all that work into those panels. You look at those, you know, three-page comic he did, and the first panel looks like it took 2 weeks to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just don't understand how he was able to draw that way and still make a living. But it's great. It's great that he was... There's something innately noble about someone who devotes themselves to that kind of love and craft like that over everything else. I think that's beautiful beyond words.
And it's nice that some of these guys actually got some attention near the end of their lives, too. The fact that there was some payoff. The odds were so against it. It would be like, they couldn't have imagined when they were doing those works that there would be, like, you know, conventions put together of comic books where people would be coming up to them. It'd be like if you'd worked in refrigerator pamphlets. And later, the huge industry grew around it. They're like, wow, they really did like my refrigerator pamphlet.
Well, did it vary, though? I mean, because Seth, you're very interested in John Stanley, and he was sort of horrified by the fact that people were interested in the comics
The other side of the Comic Con. He saw who was interested.
circle back to this earlier issue of the... Maybe we should actually pursue that, like the sort of love-hate relationship with sort of fandom or with fan culture, which you can kind of see in Wimbledon Green or the Dan Pussy stories. And with some of the comments Jim had made earlier about how angry he was, which I think the Dan Pussy stories might explain.
I'm just an angry guy.
Is there a sense in which comic book culture is both kind of nurturing, but is also frustrating, and or has it changed?
Well, comic book culture is kind of fascinating. All fan culture is, but it's fascinating because part of any kind of like kind of nerdy pursuits are there is a, both a charming and a horrifying side to it. I mean, the traditional kind of comic fan that, you know, like came up in the 60s and 70s, there's something very charming about these horn-rimmed glasses guys sitting around in their basement making like mimeographed fanzines and sending them through the mail to each other. The other side of it is, of course, is that a lot of fan culture is like really repulsive too, because it's too, it's really insular, and you know, it draws certain types that people make fun of. You know, like the idea of like people with like, you know, poor social skills, or the fact that there's like a game that sort of fetishization quality to it, and often the things that are fetishized are embarrassing when like shown out in the real world. So like when you look at a comic book convention on the surface. Not TCAF, of course. You see like, you know, these kind of images held up that are absolutely frightening in the real world, like, you know, these barbarian women and super-powered Iron Men, and it's all very strange and frightening.
But when we all started, things like superheroes, Lord of the Rings, things like that, the general public looked on those with utter disdain. You know,
if you went
out on a date and said, like, my favorite book is The Hobbit,
please.
And if you said, like, I really wish they'd make a movie of Iron Man, that would have died. Well, and yet now that's utterly mainstream. You know,
well, the whole world is a comic book.
The whole world has the nerds have won.
Yeah,
and the whole world has embraced that culture, and we've never had our day. You know, so we've always thought, like, we used to think, like, we're doing the mainstream comics because ours are for adults and they're not about superheroes. And it turned out we never were. We were always doing stuff that was a very limited interest to a general audience, and that really all the stuff that we thought of as like these weird fanboys are into that actually was stuff that has much bigger mass appeal than we ever imagined.
Yeah, all those years that like the mass media was giving people doctors and detectives and stuff, they didn't realize they were waiting for like the true crap of comic books.
Right.
That's what people really wanted.
So I guess Dan Fussy has become America.
He won. Take a bow.
Okay. So we have 15 minutes left. I thought we might open up the floor to some questions from the audience, if people have questions. Yes?
I was going to say, you guys talked a lot about how kind of the comic world, bringing back to what we first brought up, that comics don't really work anymore, it's books, but I think, does that only apply more to the alternative and underground comic world? Because I don't quite see that trend in more of the mainstream comics, so I was wondering what your opinion on that is. I mean, I know there's still like the trade paperbacks, but it seems that almost everything, if it's in book form, was previously released in comic form.
Well, I don't know a ton about the mainstream publishing world, but of comic books. But it seems to me that the sales of, like, say, Superman or comics like that have declined dramatically in the last 40 years, to the point now that those comic books are selling, like, some of them on the same level that alternative comics were selling in the 80s. And it seems to me, I could be wrong, but it seems to me that that market exists as a kind of an artificial market. It's because there's a group of guys who buy their comics every week and they're still catering to them, and they're keeping those trademarks alive by putting out those comic books. I think if they, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, they just transferred all that material over to video games and movies at some point and just said, like, this is a waste of our time publishing these comic books.
I think it creates like a grassroots fandom that they can test out, you know, stories and plots. And if something really catches fire, there's your next movie. And
yeah, it probably does supply a good, yeah, like a source for material for them. But it can't be still viable in the way that it used to be.
Peter Laird of the Ninja Turtles was saying that even though the Ninja Turtle books don't make any money anymore, he's really committed to keep putting them out because he feels like that's where he can experiment and play and come up with new ideas. And
they're still making Ninja Turtle comics?
They are.
Scoop. Wow.
Yes?
I was wondering if
there
are any other comic books
that
so you made some comments about the differences in the technology for producing comics. I guess one of the things I'm wondering about, if you start looking now, there's all these different technologies for reading books that are coming out onto the market that are optimized for black and white print books in some way. But I'm just wondering how you feel, how you might feel that is also going to affect the way your industry is going to go, and what kinds of things, and how this will affect artists who are producing things with this new technologies as well.
Do you guys want to take this?
I mean, I feel like I'm committed to the sinking ship that is the book publishing business. I'm going down with the ship, and if they want to figure out a way to put things on a Kindle or an iPad or whatever, that's okay with me. But I'm not going to ever work with that in mind. I think a book is kind of, you can't beat a book. It's sort of the perfect thing. It's not going to talk back at you, and it's not going to ask for your credit card, and it's not going to, it's its own thing. It's its own, I love that a book is its own isolated, unified world that exists within these covers, and that there's no other opportunities for it to do anything else. I think that's very important. So, and I just don't trust any of the hopeful wishes for the new technology. It's like we've heard it all so many times before, and I don't see it ever working out for us somehow.
Also, you could spend a few years like creating something for the iPad, and you're thinking about the dimensions and the size and the relationship to the panels, to the screen, and then iPad 7 comes out and it's wider or narrower, and then what? So
yeah. Kind of what Jim was saying earlier too about the tradition of working with the tools. I feel that tradition with the book as well. Print technology just feels like something I have an innate attraction to. I don't feel any the very texture of like the new digital world has no appeal to me. When the day comes where they're like, this is the only way you're going to make a living, I'll say, well, okay, well, you can scan my pages and put them on this thing, whatever it is. I just don't want to have one. But I'm saying, can we still print up a couple copies for me to have in my library? I'm just not interested in reading things that way, and it doesn't appeal to me. I'm sure a whole new generation of cartoonists will come along that will find that as the primary appeal. They'll grow up with digital technology, and they'll have the same connection to it that I have to print. But I am not the person to be like talking to about that, because I'm definitely of the old world. That finite quality of the book, like Dan was talking about, it's like when I go to a blog and start looking at some photo blog or something, I'm just like, I don't want this. I just want a book of these pictures. I want something that someone has edited and made like a finite product out of. I don't want a never-ending series of photographs that will be posted for the rest of my life. I need that finite quality. I need the editorial process that makes a book somehow. And so it's just, I'm sure that these things will have their day, but for myself, it really will have no effect on what I'm actually doing.
Well, perhaps to follow up on that, I mean, I think one of the interesting things in comics, particularly the type of comics that you guys are making, is that there's a lot of emphasis now on book design, and often with the cartoonist doing their own design. And I feel that in some ways that's a way of creating a space for the continued existence of the book. That like a lot, like a book like Wilton or Jimmy Corrigan, it's kind of hard to imagine them existing in any other form than they do. So, like, how important is book design in trying to, like, reclaim the book as something that should continue to exist?
I mean, I feel like that's a direction that we can go in, and that there will always be some kind of a small audience for very well-produced books. You know, there are people who love books, and you can release $1,000 books, and there are people who will buy them. And if we have to move even farther in that direction, doing more and more lavish books to sort of claim our own territory away from, as separate from something that's online, I think that's something that we could look at. I'd certainly be interested in going that direction rather than simplifying everything and just sort of throwing it up, giving it over to technology.
I was surprised to find out how important the design turned out to be once I started doing it.
Yeah.
Like, I think you mentioned back in the 80s, last night you might have mentioned this, like, just, how kind of crappy the books were. Just finished up your comic, and then it went into a trade paperback or something, and they were a bit perfunctory. It was really about doing the comics, mm-hmm. and the book was a collection of the comics. But now, I think as more cartoonists have become involved in the design of their own books, and I think you can see that the design of the book actually is important to how the book is read, mm-hmm. and that more and more you can see that, at least for myself, I feel like the actual package of the book determines the feel of the story some way, or it influences it. It's very important, like all the design choices you make. I would feel really regretful to throw all that out the window and just, you know, have the content just placed on something. The very package itself is really important to me.
Yeah. Well, I remember during the 80s and early 90s when I would want to do something extravagant with a book collection of my stuff, and it was too expensive. Now, I think largely thanks to the computer, you can use stereolithography to make embossing plates.
Yeah, it's true.
You can do die cuts. You can do things that used to be prohibitively expensive. Now books are very cheap to make. The printing is uniformly good. A lot has changed.
That's true. I mean, I'm always knocking the computer, but the one thing is, I remember when we first started to phase over to using computers, I was really negative about like how shitty all the pixelization was. I was always complaining about everything, but ultimately it really has led to a revolution in printing technology, and it's, you know, it's great to be able to have these tools at your command.
Like doing this kind of work for a living now, how do you reconcile like fully pursuing whatever concept you have and like creating something that is like that communicates, that people can like the mass audience can like react to and have a relationship with? Like, do you ever find that you will have to like step down from a big idea because it might be ambitious that people might not understand? And like, what are your ethical like thoughts on that? Like, having to maybe sacrifice a bit of your ambition to appease like a publisher or a mass audience or something?
I would guess that nobody up here has ever done that.
Yeah, I don't know if I see it as my comics as making a living. I feel like I still have a day job.
I mean, but, you know, I'm always trying to, in my work, trying to think what would appeal to a general reader. You know, I'm trying to think about that person who doesn't necessarily, you know, have an affinity for comics or, you know, steeped in the history of comics. I'm always trying to think what would like a friend of my parents say if they read one of these comics, and trying to find something universal in that. And I think, you know, it's not necessarily that I'm trying to reach a big audience, but I want to communicate on some level that's perhaps deeper than just, you know, on a formal level, or, you know, solving a formal issue and finding, you know, comic fans approving of that. I want it to be something more emotional than that.
I don't think I ever think about like the content and the audience, but I certainly do think about the communication of the ideas. Like, it's, you know, how do I present this in a way that's like readable and enjoyable? But I don't think I ever, like, I certainly never think about my parents' friends, whether they would enjoy it. My parents didn't have any friends. But I do think, like, when I'm, you know, whatever esoteric interest I might be pursuing that might come out in the work, it's really just all about how do I present this to another person that I can communicate this properly to them so that they'll feel what I'm feeling. That's my main concern with it.
Yes?
All of you have done autobiographical comics, or at least the ones whose work I know on the panel, but you seem to be doing less and less of that as time goes on. Is autobiography a young person's game in comics, or is there more opportunity?
We should direct the question to Chester, because he's doing autobiographical comics.
Yeah, right. My current book is the one I'm working on right now. It's a biographical book. So I'm not giving up the form.
No, I think it's a valid form. I stopped using it for bigger projects just because I found using myself as the main character was really problematic when you're writing. But I still use autobiography in my sketchbooks. I still write like autobiographical stories in my next volume of Palookaville, the first one coming out of the book. There's some sketchbook material that's autobiographical, and I think it's a natural form, like the memoir form, basically, that all writers use it. I think in the 80s there was like probably more of a predominance of it because we were trying to get away from the sort of fantasy tropes of the mainstream, and I think it was just natural that a lot of cartoonists moved as far away from that as possible, directly to like real life experience. But I think there will always be autobiographical comics.
I don't think I've ever actually done an autobiographical comic.
Yeah,
sort of. It was
you made fun of autobiographical comics.
I made fun of it, yeah.
I did the stroll.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear a sort of a backlash against autobiographical comic. You hear people say, who wants to see another story about a boring guy at Starbucks complaining about his girlfriend? But sort of the presumption of that assertion is that it would be better to see a superhero comic made up by a boring guy who works at or anything that this guy made up. Yeah. And I think I'd rather see a transcription of somebody's real life, you know, before I would like to see that person attempt fiction, because that's a whole nother set of difficulties.
And a lot of times the voyeuristic quality of autobiographical stuff is great.
If it's honest, it's always interesting.
Yeah. People are always complaining about what Joe Matt's doing, but I can't think of anything more interesting than a new issue of Peep Show.
No.
On that note, we should always end with praise for Joe Matt. That's the best note. It's a note of hope and
hope for a new Peep Show.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to thank the panelists and thank you all for coming.